Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Time of Omens by Catherine Kerr, narrated by Ruth Urquhart. Prologue. Umglaith, 1096. On the inner plains, time as we know it no longer exists. This is why an omen may refer to things which we perceive as long over and done with, as well as to things in the process at the moment in which the omen is cast, and to things which we have yet to perceive at all. Past, present, future, these states do not exist in the world from which an omen proceeds, yet there is no denying, of course, that they do exist in ours. The Pseudo-Iamblichus Scroll. In those days, the eastern border of the elven lands lay in the middle of a forest. A traveller leaving the high plains and heading east came down a long, gentle decline into the oaks to find several rivers that might mark a border, if only anyone at all had lived on either side of them. In that vast tangle of tree and shrub, bracken and thorn, finding the lands of men, that is, the three western provinces, Eldith, Pierdin, Arcoth, of the kingdom of Deveri, was no easy job. If you wanted to go from west to east, the sandy coast of the southern sea made a much more reliable road, if, of course, you could fight your way south to reach it. The ancient forest had a way of tricking travellers, unless they or their companions knew the route well. The woman who rode out of the forest late on a summer day travelled with a horde of such companions, not that most human beings would have seen them. Sylphs and sprites hovered round her in the air. Gnomes clung to her saddle or perched on the back of the spare horse she was leading. Undines rose out of every stream and pool she passed to wave a friendly greeting. Her friends weren't the only odd thing about Jill. If you look carefully at her silver hair, cropped short like a lad's, and the fine lines that webbed her eyes round and latticed her cheeks, you realised that she had to be at least 50 years old, if not somewhat more. But she radiated so much vitality, the way a fire gives off heat, that it was impossible to think of her as anything but young. She was, you see, the most powerful sorcerer in all of Deveri. The first human settlement that any traveller coming from the west reached on the coast was the holy precinct of Umglaith, although in those days before the silting of the river and the meddling of humans had extended the shore, the temple lay a little ways out to sea on a low-lying cluster of islands. Jill rode along the sea cliffs through meadows of tall grass to a rocky beach, where the waves washed over gravel with a mutter, as if the sea were endlessly regretting some poor decision. A fair mile offshore, she could see the rise of the main island against the glitter of the southern sea. She led her pair of horses down to the two stone pillars that marked the entrance to a stone causeway, still under water at the moment. Then when she looked at the water lapping at the carved notches along the edge of one pillar, she found each wave falling a little lower than the one before. Crying and mewling, seabirds swooped overhead. Graceful gulls and the ungainly pelicans that were sacred to the god all come to feed as the dropping tide exposed the rocky shallows. At last the causeway emerged, streaming water like a silver sea-snake, to let her lead her horses across the uncertain footing. At the far end of the causeway stood a stone arch inlaid with coloured marble in panels of interlace and roundels decorated with pelicans. It sported an inscription, too. Water covers and reveals all things. About 10 miles long and 7 wide, with a central hill standing in the midst of meadows of coarse seagrass, the island sheltered 4 different temple complexes at that time. Brocks as tall as a lord's dun, clusters of wooden guest houses, cattle barns and riding stables, as well as a series of holy shrines placed at picturesque locations. Although the temple had been founded in the year 690 as a modest refuge for scholars and mystics, during the long civil wars of the 9th century, its priests had the shrewdness and the good fortune to play a crucial role in placing the true king on his throne. When the wars were over, their fame drew an occasional desperate soul seeking an oracle, and as the long years went by, the rare case became a swarm of pilgrims, all laden with gifts to earn the favour of the god. Now, was rich. Still leading her horses rather than riding, Jill left the causeway and followed a fine road paved with limestone blocks through the smallish town that had sprung up near the temples. In among the round thatched houses townsfolk and visitors strolled around or sat in the windows of one of the many inns, and peddlers kept accosting her with trays of sweetmeats or baskets of little silver medals and pottery souvenirs. She brushed them all off and strode on her way, skirting the main complex too, bustling with the visitors and priests here in the summer season, and took a little used path that ran southeast through pine trees, all twisted and bowed down from the constant wind. In a little bay of rocky shore, a jetty stood, with a ferry bobbing at anchor beside it. Beyond, a scant mile away, she could see the rise of East Island, a long sliver of land that most visitors knew or cared nothing about.
"Jill! Hello!"
The ferryman, a stout priest draped in an orange cloak, waved both hands at her as she led her horses gingerly down the steep path.
"Back so soon?"
"I am at that. How have things been? Quiet?"
"They always are, out our way."
He grinned, revealing brown and broken teeth.
"His Holiness has pains in his joints again."
"I'm surprised you aren't all as bent and stiff as village crones, frankly, out here in the fog."
"True, true. But well, we've got a bit of sun today at least. Enjoy it while we can, say I."
Since the tide was running out, the journey was quick and easy, though the ferryman was bound to have a harder trip rowing back by himself. Jill coaxed her horses off, left him sighing at the job ahead, and headed across a wind-scoured meadow to a complex much smaller and plainer than those of the main island. At the base of a low hill stood a clutter of roundhouses and stables, shaded by a few stunted oaks. Dust drifted and swirled over the threadbare lawns and sickly vegetable gardens. She turned her horses over to a groom, carried her saddlebags and bedroll to a hut that did for a guest house, dumped her gear onto the narrow cot, and decided that she'd unpacked. With a deferential bob of his head, a servant came in, bringing her a wash basin and a pitcher of water.
"His Holiness is in the library. I'll join him there."
After she washed up, she lingered in the silence for a moment to get her questions clear in her mind. Like all the other pilgrims, she'd come to Umm's temple for help in making a decision, in her case about a voyage to the far-lying islands of the Bardekian archipelago, a very major undertaking indeed in those days. It was likely that she'd be gone for years, and almost as likely that she wouldn't even find what she was looking for, the translation of a single word that she'd found inscribed inside a ring. The word, written in elvish characters, though it made no sense at all in any language, might have been a name or sheer nonsense for all that she knew. What she did know, in the mysterious way that Dweomer masters have, was that the inscription would make the difference between life and death to thousands of people, men and elves alike. When, she didn't exactly know. Someday, perhaps even soon. She suspected, but only suspected, that the answer lay in Bardek. She was hoping that the priests of Umm could either confirm her suspicion or lay it to rest. The library of Umm was at that time an oblong building in the Bardek style of whitewashed stucco, roofed in clay tiles to cut down the fire danger. Inside, in a row of hearths, peat fires constantly smouldered to keep the chill and damp off the collection of over 500 books and scrolls, a vast wealth of learning for the time. Jill found the chief librarian, Surin, standing at his lectern by a window with a view of the oak trees beyond. Unrolled in front of him was a Bardekian scroll. He looked up and smiled at her. As always, his weak eyes were watering from the effort of reading.
"Oh, there you are, Jill. I've been looking for that reference you wanted."
"The history scroll. You found it."
"I have indeed, and just now, so it's a good thing you wandered in like this. Must be an omen."
Although he was joking, Jill felt a line of cold run down her back.
"In fact, I found both of the sources you were talking about."
He tapped the papyrus in front of him with a bone stylus.
"Here's the scroll, and it does indeed have a reference to elves living in the islands. Well, maybe they're elves anyway. Take a look at it, and I'll just fetch the codex."
The scroll was an ancient chronicle of the city-state of Ar-Barat, lying far south in the Bardekian Islands. Since Jill had learned to read Bardechian only recently, it took her some minutes to puzzle out the brief entry. A shipwrecked man was washed up on shore near the harbour. His name was Terso, a merchant of Mangorat. There was a long bit here about the Archon's attempt to repatriate the man, which Jill skipped through. Before he left us, Terso told of his adventures. He claimed to have travelled far, far south, beyond even An Murdio, and to have discovered a strange people who dwelt in the jungles. These people, he claimed, were more akin to animals than men, because they lived in trees and had long pointed ears. Because he was so ravaged by fever, none took his words seriously. "Curse them all," Jill snapped.
"They don't truly go into detail, do they?"
Surin came up at her elbow.
"Here's the Lucarn Codex. Do be careful with it, won't you? It's very old."
"Of course I will, Your Holiness. Don't trouble your heart about that. May I take it back to the guest house to read? I need to rest from my journey."
Surin blinked at her for a moment.
"Oh, you've been gone, of course. Silly of me. By all means, keep it with you if you'd like. There's a lectern in the hut."
"A good one, and a candle spike, too."
Jill bathed and ate a sparse dinner before she got around to looking at the codex. By then, early in the evening, the fog was coming in thick, darkening the hut and turning it chilly, too. She laid a fire in the hearth, lit it by the simple means of invoking the wild folk of fire with a snap of her fingers, then stuck a reading candle, as long and thick as a child's arm, onto the cast-iron spike built into the lectern. Before she lit the candle, though, she sat down on the floor by the fire to watch the salamanders playing in the flames and to think for a while about the work she had in hand, gathering every scrap of available information about the mysterious inscription. Although it was a pretty thing, made of dwarven silver engraved with roses, the ring itself carried no particular magic. It might, however, be important as a clue. She already knew much of its history. Once it had belonged to a human bard named Mathin, who had travelled to the western lands and given it to an elven dwellmer master as a gift. That master had in turn given it to a mysterious race of not truly corporeal beings called the Guardians. She was assuming that the Guardians had added the unintelligible inscription for the simple reason that the ring hadn't been inscribed before they'd got hold of it. But when one of their kind returned it to the physical world by giving it to another bard, Elvin this time, and named Deverberial, it carried its little riddle. As far as Dwemer Masters could tell, the Guardians perceived important omens about future possibilities as easily as most men see the sun. Since they insisted that the inscription had some important weird to fulfil, Jill saw no reason to doubt them. Abstract terms like why, however, seemed to have no meaning for them, and it was much in the way of explanation that they'd left out of their tale. As she always did toward evening, she found herself thinking about her old master in the Dwemer and missing him. Although Nevin had been dead for months now, at times her grief stabbed so sharply that it seemed he'd died just the day before. "If only he were here," she would think. "He'd unravel this wretched puzzle fast enough." A grey gnome, a creature she'd known for years, materialised next to her and climbed onto her lap. All spindly arms and legs and long warty nose, he looked up at her with his pinched little face twisted into a creditable imitation of human sadness.
"You miss Nevin too, don't you?" Jill said. "Well, he's gone on now like he had to. All of us do, in our time."
Although the gnome nodded, she doubted if he understood. In a moment he jumped off her lap, found a copper coin wedged into a crack in the floor, and became engrossed with pulling it out. Jill wondered if she would ever meet Nevin again, in the long cycles of death and rebirth. Only if she needed to, she supposed, and she knew that it would be years and years before he would be reborn again, long after her own death, no doubt, though well before her next birth. Although all souls rest in the inner lands between lives, Nevin's life had been so unnaturally prolonged by Dwemer, he'd lived well over 400 years all told, that his corresponding interval of rest would doubtless be unusually long as well, or so she could speculate. It was for the Lords of Weird to decide, not her. She told herself that often, even as her heart ached to see him again. Finally, in a fit of annoyance over her mood, she got up and went to the lectern to read, but the chronicle only made her melancholy worse. She'd been trying to recall an event that had happened in one of her own previous lives, but she could remember it only dimly, because even a great Dwayoma master like her could call to mind only the most general outlines and the occasional tiny memory picture of former lives. She was sure, though, from that dim memory, that she, or rather her previous incarnation, because she'd been born into a male body in that cycle, had been present at the forging of the Rose Ring. During that life, as the warrior known as Branoic, she'd ridden with a very important band of soldiers, the true king's personal guard in the civil wars, that much she could remember. What she'd forgotten was that Nevin had been not only present, but very much an important actor in those events, perhaps the most important figure of all. There was his name, written on practically every page. As she read the composed speeches the chronicler had put into his mouth, she found herself shaking her head in irritation. He never would have sounded so stiff, so formal. All at once, she realized that she was crying. The flood of long-buried grief, not only for Nevin, but for other friends her soul had forgotten this 200 years and more, seemed to work a Dwayoma of its own. Rather than merely reading the chronicler's dry account, she found herself remembering the isolated lake fort of Dun Druilach, where Nevin had tutored the young prince who was destined to become king, and the long ride that the Silver Daggers had taken to bring the prince to Caermore and his destiny. All night she stood there, reading some parts of the tale, remembering others, until the sheer fascination of the puzzle buried her grief again.
Past. Pierden and de Very, 8:43. Nothing is ever lost. The Pseudo-Jamblichus Scroll.
1. The year 8:43. In Caermore that winter, near the shortest day, there were double rings round the moon for 2 nights running. On the third night, King Glynn died in agony after drinking a goblet of mead. The Holy Chronicles of Lucan. The morning dawned clear of cold, with a snap of winter left in the wind. But toward noon the wind died, and the day turned warm. As he led his horse and the princes out of the stables, Branoic was whistling at the prospect of getting free of the fortress for a few hours. After a long winter shut up in Dun Druilach, he felt as if the high stone walls had marched in and made everything smaller.
"Going out for a ride, lad?"
Branoic swirled round to see the prince's counsellor, Nevin, standing in the cobbled ward next to a broken wagon. Although the Silver Dagger couldn't say why, Nevin always startled him. For one thing, for all that he had a shock of snow-white hair and a face as wrinkled as burlap, the old man strode around as vigorously as a young warrior. For another, his ice-blue eyes seemed to bore into a man's soul.
"We are, sir,"
Branoic said with a bob of his head that would just pass for a humble gesture.
"I'm just bringing out the prince's horse too, you see. We've all been stable-bound too long this winter."
"True enough. But ride carefully, will you? Guard the prince well."
"Of course, sir. We always do."
"Do it doubly this morning. I've received an omen."
Branoic turned even colder than the brisk morning wind would explain. As he led the horses away, he was glad that he was going to be riding out with the prince rather than stuck home with his tame sorcerer. All winter, Nevin had been wondering whether King in Caermore would die. But he didn't get the news until that very day, just before the spring equinox. The night before, it had rained over Dun Druilach, dissolving the last pockets of snow in the shade of the walls and leaving pools of brown mud in their stead. About 2 hours before noon, when the sky started clearing in earnest, the old man climbed to the ramparts and looked out over the slate-grey lake, choppy in the chill wind. He was troubled, wondering why he'd received no news from Caermore in 5 months. With those who followed the Dark Dwayoma keeping a watch on the Dun, he'd been afraid to contact other Dwayoma masters through the fire, in case they were overheard. But now he was considering taking the risk. All the omens indicated that the time was ripe for King Glynn's weird to come upon him. Yet, as he stood there, debating, he got his news in a way that he had never expected. Down below in the ward, there was a whooping and a clatter that broke his concentration. In extreme annoyance, he turned on the rampart and looked down to see Marin galloping through the gates at the head of his squad of 10 men. The prince was holding something shiny in his right hand and waving it about as he pulled his horse to a halt.
"Page, go find Nevin right now."
"I'm up here, lad,"
Nevin called back.
"I'll come down."
"Don't. I'll come up. It'll be private that way."
Marin dismounted, tossed his reins to a page, and raced for the ladder. Over the winter, he had grown another 2 inches, and his voice had deepened as well, so that more and more he looked the perfect figure of the king-to-be, blonde and handsome, with a far-seeing look in his grey eyes. Yet he was still lad enough to shove whatever it was he was holding into his shirt and scramble up the ladder to the ramparts. Nevin could tell from the haunted look in his eyes that something had disturbed him.
"What's all this, my liege?"
"We found summit, Nevin. The Silver Daggers and me, I mean. After you saw us leave, we went down the east running road. It was about 3 miles from here that we found them."
"Found who?"
"The corpses. They'd all been slain by the sword. There were 3 dead horses, but only 2 men in the road. But we found the 3rd man out in a field, like he'd tried to run away before they killed him."
With a grunt of near physical pain, Nevin leaned back against the cold stone wall.
"How long ago were they killed?"
"Oh, a ghastly long time."
Marin looked half sick at the memory.
"Mathin says it was probably a couple of months. They froze first, he said, and then thawed probably just last week. The ravens have been working on them. It was truly grim. And all their gear was pulled apart and strewn around, like someone had been searching through it."
"Oh, no doubt they were. Could you tell anything about these poor wretches?"
"They were Caermore men. Here."
Marin reached into his shirt and pulled out a much tarnished message tube.
"This was empty when we found it, but look at the device. I rubbed part of it clean on the ride home."
Nevin turned the tube and found the polished strip, graved with 3 tiny ships.
"You could still see the paint on one shield, too," Marin went on. "It was the ship Blazon. I wish we had the messages that were in that tube."
"So do I, Your Highness. But I think me I know what they said. We'd best go down and collect the entire troop. No doubt we're months too late, but I won't rest easy until we have a look round for the murderers."
As they hurried back to the Brock, it occurred to Nevin that he no longer had to worry about communicating with his allies by Dwayoma. It was obvious that their enemies already knew everything they needed to know. Even though Mathin considered hunting the murderers a waste of time, and he knew that every other man in the troop was dreading camping out in the chilly damp, no one so much as suggested arguing with Nevin's scheme. If anyone had, Mathin himself would have been the one to do it, because he was a bard of sorts, with a bard's freedom to speak on any matter at all, as well as being second in command of this troop of mercenaries newly become the prince's guard. The true commander, Caradoc, was too afraid of Nevin to say one wrong word to the old man, while Mathin was, in some ways, the only real friend Nevin had. Carrying what provisions the Dun could spare them at the end of winter's lean times, the Silver Daggers, with the prince and old Nevin riding at the head of the line, clattered out the gates just at noon. With them was a wagon and a couple of servants with shovels to give the bodies a decent burial.
"Release the blasted clouds have all blown away," Caradoc said with a sigh. "Had a chance for a word with the king's chief huntsman, by the by. He says that there's an old hunting lodge about 10-12 miles to the northeast, right on the river. If we can find it, it might still have a roof of sorts."
"If we're riding that way to begin with."
They found the murdered men and their horses where they'd left them, and it ached Mathin's heart to think how close they'd been to safety when their weird fell upon them. While the servants looked for a place where the thawing ground was good and soft, Nevin coursed back and forth like a hunting dog and examined everything. The dead men, the horses, the soggy ground around them.
"You and the men certainly trampled all over everything, Matho," he grumbled.
"Well, we looked for footprints and tracks and such like.
If they'd left a trail, we would have found it. But you've got to remember that the ground was frozen hard when this happened.
True enough. Where's the third lad, the one who almost got away?
Mathin took him across the field to the sprawled and puffing corpse. In the warming day, the smell was loathsome enough to make the bard keep his distance. But Nevin knelt right down next to the thing and began to examine the ground as carefully as if he were looking for a precious jewel. Finally, he stood up and walked away with one last, disgusted shake of his head.
"Find anything?"
"Naught. I'm not even sure what I was hoping to get, to tell you the truth. It just seems that..."
Nevin let his words trail away and stood there slack-mouthed for a moment.
"I want to wash my hands off, and I see a stream over there."
Mathin went with him while he knelt down and, swearing at the coldness of the water, scrubbed his hands in the rivulet. All at once, the old man went tense, his eyes unfocused, his mouth slack again, his head tilted a little as if he listened to a distant voice. Only then did Mathin notice that the streamlet brimmed with glassy blue undines, rising up in crests and wavelets. In their midst, and yet somehow beyond them, like a man coming through a doorway from some other place, was a presence. Mathin could barely see it, a vast silvery shimmer that seemed to partake of both water and air, like some preternatural fog, forming itself into a shape that might not even have existed beyond his desire to see it as a shape. Then it was gone, and Mathin shuddered once with a toss of his head.
"Geese walking on your grave?"
Nevin said mildly. When Mathin looked around, he saw Owain and the prince walking over to them, and well within earshot.
"Must be, truly. Here, Owain, did you and the lads find anything new?"
"Doubt me if there's aught to find. Young Branowick did come up with this, though. Insisted it might be important, but he couldn't say why."
Owain looked positively sour as he handed Nevin a thin sliver of bone, about 6 inches long, barely a half-inch wide, but pointed on both ends.
"Sometimes I think that lad is daft. I truly do."
"Not at all."
Nevin was turning the sliver round and round in his thin, gnarled fingers.
"It's human bone, to begin with. And look how someone's worked it, smoothed it, shaped it, and then polished it."
"What?"
Owen's sourness deepened to disgust.
"What is it? Some kind of knife handle?"
"It's not, but a stylus to rule lines on parchment."
"A stylus?" Mathin broke in. "Who would make a thing like that out of human bone?"
"Who indeed, Matho lad? That's the answer I'd very much like to have. Who indeed?"
In his role as a learned man, Nevin recited a few suitable lines of dawntime poetry over the corpses. Then the silver daggers mounted up and left the servants to get on with the burying. When they rode out, they headed for the river. Mathin spurred his horse up next to the old man's and mentioned the decrepit hunting lodge.
"It'll be better shelter than none, truly," Nevin said.
"You don't suppose our enemies camp there, do you?"
"They might have once, but they're long gone by now."
He gave Mathin a wink.
"I have some rather reliable information to that effect. Tell the men we won't be out hunting wild geese long, Matho. I just want one last look around, that's all."
Only then was Mathin sure that he had indeed seen some exalted personage in the stream. Just at sunset they reached the lodge, a wooden roundhouse, its thatch half gone, standing along with the stables, behind a palisade that was missing as many logs as a peasant his teeth. As soon as they rode within 500 yards of the place, the horses turned nervous, tossing their heads and blowing, dancing a little in the muddy road. Mathin had the feeling that they would have bolted if they hadn't been tired from their long day's ride.
"Oho!" Nevin said. "My liege, you wait here with Caradoc and most of the men. Mathin, you, Owain and Branowick, come with me."
"You'd better take more men than that, Councillor,"
Marin said.
"I won't need a small army, my liege. Most like there's naught left here but bad memories, anyway."
"But the horses..."
"See things men don't see, but men know things that horses don't know.
and with that riddle you'll have to rest content.
Nevin was right enough in the event, although the bad memory turned out to be...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?